right, so as we said a moment ago, we are in the book of Ezra. Brother Shane went through chapters 1 through 6. And just a quick review of all of those chapters, it's the first return of the exile. The Israelite nation as a whole has been in exile now for almost 70 years, and that's what God said. Your punishment will be 70 years, and then I will bring back a remnant for me of my people, and they will glorify me, and they will honor me, and they will worship me. And that's what he's doing now, as he is starting to use the kingdoms that once ruled over the Israelite people and destroyed Jerusalem. He is using those same kingdoms now to allow the Israelite people to come back to Jerusalem. So in the first return, we found out in 539 BC, King Cyrus of Persia. Now, I thought it was the Babylonians that captured Israel and Judah and put him into captivity. So why is it Persia here that is allowing the Israelite people to come back? What's transpired in this amount of time? Are the Babylonians in control now? No, they've been destroyed by Persia. So Persia is the ruling kingdom. They are the kingdom now that has the superpower. And the Babylonians are destroyed. And so, yes, the Israelite people are still in Babylonian territory, and they are still subject to foreign kings, but it's the king of Persia, and it's King Cyrus. And in chapter 1, it says, God moved the heart of King Cyrus, a decree to send the people back to their homelands. Well, that allowed the people of Jerusalem to be a part of that and to come back to Jerusalem and to be a group of God's people once again. And so in the year of King Cyrus of Persia, he allowed people to come back, and almost 42,300 was the first group of exiles that came back into Jerusalem. And we talked about that. That was stage one, where they come in, and under the leadership of Zerubbabel, they start building the temple. And they were very enthusiastic about that when they first got there and they first started, and then they started getting pushback from the people in the land, the foreigners who were there. Because if you remember, what do the kings who conquer a land do to that particular group of people in the land? What is it they do with when they conquer lands or territories? Yeah, they switch them, right? They move them around. They don't want to disrupt them to keep them from being able to rebel and start another war. So they keep the simplest of people in the land, but they take so many of them out and they disperse them to different places. Well, in the land of Judah, you have foreigners living there. And so now these Israelite people are coming back and they want to build the temple and they want to, you know, move back into Jerusalem. But the foreigners around, they say, wait a minute, we're here and we don't want you to do this. And so they start to have a difficulty of being able to build the temple. And so it goes on for a long period of time. Does anyone recall about how long it took them to finally get the temple built once they got back to Jerusalem and they got started? What was the time frame, do you recall, about how long from the time they got back to Jerusalem to the actual building of the temple and the finishing? It was approximately 20 years. 20 years before they finally finished building the temple of God. So it was a very long time, but it took them that long. And an interesting part of the second half of 1 through 6, it says, under King Darius of Persia, he allowed the finishing of the temple. So now we already see that there's a transition of kings in Persia. It was King Cyrus, but now it's King Darius. So we have our second king mentioned from the king of Persia, and he is the one who writes the letter in the year about 18th year, saying, y'all leave just all the foreigners, you folks leave them alone. I am giving them total authorization. They are going to build the temple of God. And it's interesting, you see God's work in all of this. It's because here they are up against these people. These people seemingly have gotten their way almost 20 years. But then you get another king, King Darius, and he writes this letter and says, listen, give them the authority and leave them alone. As a matter of fact, help them and make sure that you help them build the temple and get everything finalized. And they do. So King Darius writes that letter. They finish it. So the temple's completed in 515 BC. They have a dedication to the temple of God, and there in Jerusalem it's built. Almost 80 years later, that's chapters 1 through 6 that we just briefly went through. Any questions on that so far? I know it was very quick. But there, you see the time frame there. They left Babylon. They got to Jerusalem. Approximately 20 years later or so, they build the temple. The people have been living in the land. It says that they all go to towns and they build their homes and they're settling in. So they have this period of time that they've been there. But almost 80 years later, 458 BC, Ezra, see if there's another slide there, Jackson. Yeah, Ezra leads the people, and we'll see that starting in chapter 7. Another group, the second group of people to Jerusalem, and he is under King Artaxerxes. So now we have the third king of Persia involved in this particular effort to reestablish the people of Israel and the building and the law of the people there. So we're going to start this evening in chapter 7, where Ezra the priest returns to Jerusalem. And I just want to read these first few verses. There's a lot of names that I'm going to skip. I'm just going to tell you right up front. They're very difficult to pronounce, some of them, so I may just, like I said, skip over. But as we're reading Ezra chapter 7, and in verse 1, it says, after these things, during the reign of Artaxerxes, king of Persia, Ezra, son of Shira, the son of Ahareza, and he goes on and he talks about all the different sons until you get down to verse 5. The son of Abishiah, the son of Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron. Who's Aaron? The chief priest. Moses' brother, right? Yeah, this is the Aaron that they're talking about. So you can see the lineage of Ezra's family line here. And he is a priest. And listen to what it says. This Ezra, the one that they just gave all of the family history about, this Ezra, this is in verse 6, came up from Babylon, and he was a teacher well-versed in the law of Moses, which the Lord, the God of Israel, had given. The king had granted him everything he had asked for. For the hand of the Lord was with his God, the Lord, his God, was on him. Some of the Israelites, including priests, Levites, singers, gatekeepers, temple servants, also came up to Jerusalem in the seventh year of King Artaxerxes. So you can see now, we're in the third king of Persia. But look what's still continuing to allow to happen. They are allowed to be able to return home, come back, and reestablish their nation as Israel. And they need someone like Ezra. They need someone to bring the law, who is well-versed in the law of Moses, someone who can teach them, someone who can allow them to continue to grow and understand what the law was all about. We don't know. There was obviously prophets in the time of Zerubbabel and the people who first came back. There were prophets there who were giving direction and guidance to the people. And I'm sure because they made sacrifices, and of course they had the temple. But they needed someone with this kind of well-versed understanding who could teach them more about what the law of Moses had to say and how to live a life in which they were supposed to. So in chapter 7, we have that understanding. So it says, of course, that there were many that came with him. And in verse 8, it says, Ezra arrived in Jerusalem in the fifth month of the seventh year of the king, and he had begun his journey from Babylon on the first day of the first month. And he arrived in Jerusalem on the first day of the fifth month, for the gracious hand of his God was on him. So we see that it took about 4 months of travel from leaving Babylon to get to Jerusalem was about a four-month period. That's a pretty long time when you're having to travel through the land. That's a good question, Tommy, and I'm not sure of the answer on that. Does anyone know for sure if Ezra was born in captivity or if he was actually taken into captivity? That's something we certainly can look up, as Shane would say. That's a great question, and we'll look for the answer from you on Sunday. Can I do that? But no, that's a great question, because it was 70 years in captivity. So obviously, if he was taken into captivity, he had to have been probably a very young individual, or if he grew or was taken out of Jerusalem into captivity, then of course he would have. You know what's interesting, though, as I'm thinking about this, is he was well versed in the knowledge and understanding of the law of Moses. And I mean, he was a, so a couple things about him. He was a scribe. What was a scribe? What were they to do? Yeah, they wrote the law, right? They wrote it and kept copies of the law. But he was also a priest. So you had him as a scribe and a priest, and he was a teacher of the law, and that's what the scribes and the priests were to do. The priests obviously were there to give sacrifices and to offer, but they were also to teach the law along as the scribes. So he was this kind of individual who certainly was well versed in all of those things. So it is an interesting question, but I just don't have the answer for you on that right now. But we'll certainly look into it. So we get down into on verse 10, and it says, "For Ezra had devoted himself to the study and observance of the law of the Lord and to teaching its decrees and laws in all of Israel." And so it sounds from that verse that he might have been, unless, again, he was in exile. So one thing that maybe we haven't thought about, or I haven't thought about until I started this study, is when the people were in exile, it doesn't mean that they just stopped being Jews. It doesn't mean that they just no longer practice Judaism. Many of them did, unfortunately, but still, there were those who were still meeting and practicing the law and trying to live by the law. We know Daniel, obviously, was one of those individuals who, you know, refused to give up his obedience to God and what he was doing. So we need to understand that while they were in exile, it doesn't mean they were individuals who just forgot about God and forgot about the law and failed to obey by it. Now, I think that's why there's remnants that come back, because 70 years, you pretty well have planted your livelihood, your established families in the land. You know, no doubt that they were, you know, there. You were giving up a lot, and many of them didn't. Many of them chose to stay in Babylon. Many of them chose to stay where they were in exile, but some chose to come back, and some chose to live in back in Jerusalem and be that core group of God's people. So yeah, we see that, and of course, with Ezra. He's one of those individuals who brought a second group of people with him, and that's why we get the second return. So let's go ahead and hit the next slide, Jackson. Yes, sir. Exactly.
A practicing Jew and held on to his faith in spite of many things being in Babylon. And I think it's really fascinating that one of the big themes of Daniel is that in spite of the kingdoms of man that come and go and rise and fall, the Lord Most High reigns. And I think we really see that in the decree of Artaxerxes, because that's all of the good stuff that he gives to the Jews to rebuild and to go back is indicative of the character of God. Of his will prevail in spite of the kingdoms of men to come and go. Yeah. There's great hope in that. That's something we can see here.
Yeah, that's a great example of what you're saying, and it was actually what I was going to touch on. So thanks for stealing my thunder, but that's okay. No, no, you read the letter of King Artaxerxes that he sends to the people in Jerusalem, to the folks around that area. Matter of fact, the Euphrates, these are governors and leaders that are of the foreign nations, and he tells them, you're going to support them in whatever they ask for. But I want to touch base with just kind of off of what Jackson just said there. I read this letter, and it starts in chapter 7 and verse 12. And throughout this entire letter, and I'm just going to hit these passages touching on what he says. Now, this is a king of Persia, and I want you to listen to what he says. To Ezra the priest, a teacher of the law of the God of heaven. That's the first comment. Now, I decree that any of the Israelites in the kingdom, including priests, Levites, who wish to go to Jerusalem with you, may go. You are sent by the king and his seven advisors to inquire about Judah and Jerusalem with regard to the law of your God, which is in your hand. Then go down to the next verse. And he says, and to the moreover, you are to take with you silver and gold that the king and his advisors have freely given to the God of Israel, who dwells in Jerusalem. Now, as you read this letter, you may see that I think, as Shane mentioned, he kind of is thinking of this God as a local God, a God of Jerusalem. But yet, look at the integrity or the profound respect that he has in what he says about this God of Jerusalem. So he goes on and he says, and then we go down and he says, for the priest, the people and the priest, for the temple of their God in Jerusalem. And he mentions it again, and the temple of your God in Jerusalem. And he says, in accordance with all the will of your God, deliver to the God of Jerusalem all the articles entrusted to you for worship in the temple of your God, and anything else needed for the temple of your God, and that you may have occasion to supply, you may provide from the royal treasury. Then he goes on to say, Ezra the priest, a teacher of the law of the God of heaven, may ask you up to 100 talents of silver, 100 cores of wheat, 100 baths of wine, 100 baths of olive oil, a salt without limit. Whatever the God of heaven has prescribed, let it be done with diligence for the temple of the God of heaven. He mentions God's name 20 times as I counted it in this letter. We got to see God's hand in all of this. This is a foreign king. Yes, they have respect for other kings, I mean other lands and their so-called gods. But you see how God is in all of this? God is in control. God is moving these men. God is using this particular moment in time, King Cyrus, King Darius, King Artaxerxes. He's using these men, just exactly like he said he was going to do, to bring back the remnant of Israel. And here we see that, and it's evidence of how these kings see the God of heaven. They see the God of Jerusalem, and they recognize him as someone with authority, and they are responding to that according to God's will. I just find it fascinating, and I hope you do too, how God's plan and God's promise, he always keeps it. And he always comes through with the way he talked about it, how he prophesied it, and how he said it was going to come to pass. And we read it and we see it exactly how he said it was going to happen. So, of course, in verse 27, it says, praise be to the Lord, the God of our Father, who has put into the king's heart to bring honor to the house of the Lord in Jerusalem in this way, and who has extended his good favor to me before the king and his advisors and all the king's powerful officials. Because the hand of the Lord, my God, was on me, I took courage and gathered leading men from Israel to go up with me. So Ezra now is making preparations, and they're about to go up to Jerusalem in that four-month travel. So in chapter 7, we see two things. One, we see the summary of Ezra and the people. And it just basically is telling us what they did. They left Babylon. They had a wealth of stuff to take with them, and they had all kinds of articles of God's stuff to go into the temple, and it took them 4 months to travel. That was the summary of chapter 7. And then you get over to chapter 8, and it basically just breaks down everything that we just summarized. Chapter 8 talks about all of the individuals who were the folks that came with Ezra. And it gives a list of all the descendants, and it talks about all those folks. And then when you get into verse 15 of chapter 8, it says, I assembled them at the canal that flows toward Ava, and we camped there 3 days. So basically now he's describing what the travel looked like. And he breaks it down a bit by bit by bit until they actually get to Jerusalem. So chapter 8 is basically a dissecting of what we just read in chapter 7. What's interesting in chapter 8 that I found was that down in verse 21 of chapter 8, it says, there by the canal I proclaimed a fast so that we might humble ourselves before our God and ask him for a safe journey for us and our children with all of our possessions. They were traveling with a huge amount of wealth. Back in chapter 7, I should have probably touched base on this, they not only got wealth from the king and his officials, they got stuff from the people, the actual Jews who stayed in exile in Babylon. They gave them provisions. And then they also got gifts from the other people in Babylon. It says, from the providence of Babylon, as well as the freewill offerings from the people who stayed in Babylon that are Jews. So they got gifts from three different places, and they had all of this wealth. And yes, Ezra's a little nervous about traveling all this distance, and he says, the gracious hand, this is in verse 22, the gracious hand of our God is on everyone who looks to him, but his great anger is against all of those who forsake him. So we fasted and we petitioned our God about this, and he answered our prayer. Then I set 12 of the leading priests together, and he listed the names, and the 10 of their brothers, and I weighed out to them the offering of silver and gold and articles that the king, his advisors, his officials, and all the Israel presented that they donated to the house of our God. And, of course, it describes, again, all how much it weighed and everything. So he's breaking it up by groups so they can travel and be you know, a little bit more safe with certain amounts. But the whole point of that is that he is praying to God and they're fasting that they may have a safe journey. This is not an easy trip, folks. There are a lot of folks out there that could have attacked them and could have been, you know, bandits or whatever. And they were worried about that. They were having to travel some you know, odd places. Yes, ma'am.
And I think he was worried too that the heathens around them, if they were attacked, that their God would be doubted, that his power would be doubted.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think to your point, it's interesting that you say that, because he does say, I was ashamed to ask the king for warrior or for soldiers, because how would that look in glorifying our God? You know, if I asked the king for soldiers to protect us, could not God protect us from all of this? So he's questioning that, and I think that's a great example of what you're saying. You know, if this happens, how is it going to look if this God that he praises and that is supposed to be so mighty and so strong allows all of this to be thwarted by them being attacked and destroyed? Not very good. So he is praying to God and on behalf of all of that to ensure that God's glory is obviously going to be honored in all of this. Yes, Sir Jackson. You know, I'm not sure the answer to that. It was interesting because he says, when we checked among the people and the priests, I found no Levites. But yet, I know what it says in the beginning, that Levites actually traveled with them. But I think what it's saying, again, is the summary in chapter 7. Because he does find Levites, And they do attach themselves with them, and they do make it to Jerusalem. And so maybe that's in chapter 7 what they're referring to. But in the initial onset, when they left, there were no Levites with them. And so, of course, I think Ezra's saying, wait a minute, we have a lot of folks, but we don't have the Levites to help us in the temple, and we certainly need that. So he sends men to go find Levites, and those Levites come, and they go with them to Jerusalem in that effort. So maybe that answers your question. I think in 7, it's that summary that actually did take place, but here in 8, it's breaking it down to where it's a little bit more specific. In the beginning, they didn't, but then at the end, they did. Does that answer it? Somewhat? Okay.
But I mean, I was just wondering if perhaps maybe because you had mentioned like the moving around and like they take some people and they leave kind of the more simple working class perhaps in the land and that got mingled. And I wondered if maybe the priesthood had just been stored elsewhere in Babylon and perhaps they weren't quite, the political, didn't have the political potential that like Daniel and the nobles had that we know. So maybe they were just in a different spot of the land.
Yeah, that is a great question. I'm not sure what the answer to that, like you said, is in this particular context in the beginning. If they were available and they just chose not to go, which seems odd, they may not have been around in that particular group. I know because it says here that they do find them, and they do find them in an area, as they're traveling. So maybe, like you said, it was just a different location at the time. All right, so where are we here? So we talked about Ezra, and this, of course, is where Ezra, their routes that they take, and it took them 4 months to travel. So it's just kind of giving you a breakdown of where they went. And he even shows Zerubbabel's route when they first, their first trip from there to Jerusalem. So they leave, and they go way further north, and then they come down. And then we have Ezra, who cuts across a little bit further south. What's interesting is look at the green, the light green. Can everybody see the green square? Look at the reign of Persia here. It is the power. It is the major power kingdom. All of that area is covered by the Persian Empire. And yes, sir. Good point.
Also,
yes.
To answer Tommy's question, if Ezra is doing this a journey in 458, that's a good 140 years after the exile.
Yes.
He would have to be 140. He was born in exile.
There you go. So I guess very good. Thank you, Jeremy. So we answered those questions. It looks like that's kind of where they were. And if that's the case, what you're saying, that's a very outstanding thought that he studied and he learned and he was able to understand the law as so well that he was able to be one of those scribes and teachers of the law. All right, so we're going to move on now to chapters. So any questions on chapter 8? It really is a breakdown of just basically what we summarized. So they're in Jerusalem. So they get there, they donate all of the stuff to the temple like they're supposed to, and everything is being set up. And then we get to chapter 9, and it says, after these things had been done, which was basically setting up all of the gold and the silver and getting all of that, it says, the people of Israel, including the priests and the Levites, have not kept themselves separate from the neighboring peoples with their detestable practices. And I think that might be, Jeremy, to your answer, that the Levites might have been there in Jerusalem from the first travels. Because it says that the people, even the Levites and the priests, did not keep themselves separate from the neighboring peoples with their detestable practices, like those of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Jebusites, the Ammonites, the Moabites, the Egyptians, and the Amorites. They have taken some of their daughters as wives for themselves and their sons, and have mingled the holy race with the people around them, and the leaders and the officials have led the way in this unfaithfulness. Wow. So remember, they've been in Jerusalem now 80, 90 years. And they've been settling in the area, and they now are still allowing themselves to fall into sin by the nations around them. So I've struggled with this because I have two thoughts. One, I believe it's the people who have come back, who have settled in the land, who have been there since Jerubbaal. And they have allowed themselves to marry with the foreign nations that have been around them, because there were still other nations that have been associated in this area. And of course, there were even people that have moved in to this area by the kings, by, you know, facing the different nations together. The second thought I had was maybe some of these folks came with families that they had married in exile and were down here in Jerusalem, and these were the families that they had, and these were foreign wives because they were in exile. And if they didn't live according to the law or didn't really necessarily follow all of the law, they married foreign wives and they settled and they had wives and children. So this could have been that as well. If anybody has a thought on that, I would love to hear maybe a thought on that. Yes, Caleb. Yes.
And it seems to indicate that they were, they certainly have not been following the law properly. Exactly when did they make that error? I don't know, but...
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's what that was. So either way, whether they came and they had families when they came down from Babylon, or when they settled back into the land and they continued to, you know, settle in their towns and in their homes and all these places, they chose to take foreign wives from the areas around them because, again, they still were surrounded by other nations. However it happened, this, again, was an abomination in the eyes of God. It was wrong. It was sinful. And here Ezra, here he is, wanting to reform the law and the people and get them to start obeying God. And what does he have to deal with right up here in this situation? Intermarriage. How in the world did this happen? So we're going to read a little bit about that. And it says in verse 2, they have taken some of their daughters and wives. We read that. So this is Ezra now. When I heard this, I tore my tunic and cloak. This is verse 3 of chapter 9. Pulled hair from my head and beard and sat down appalled. Then everyone who trembled at the words of the God of Israel gathered around me because of this unfaithfulness of the exiles. And I sat there appalled until the evening sacrifice. Ezra prays to God, and he prays this very heartfelt prayer of, how, God, how did we sin against you again? And how are you going to react to this? You are a God of mercy. You are a God of grace, but we know we are sinful. And what, God, can we do? And he says in verse 9, though we are slaves, our God has not deserted us in our bondage. He has shown us kindness in the sight of the kings of Persia. He has granted us new life to rebuild the house of our God and repair its ruins. And he has given us a wall of protection in Judah and Jerusalem. But now, O our God, what can we say after this? For we have discarded the commands you have gave through your servants, the prophets, when you said the land you are entering to possess is a land polluted by the corruption of its people. By their detestable practices, they have filled it and their impurity from one end to the other. Therefore, do not give your daughters in marriage to their sons or take their daughters for your sons. Do not seek a treaty of friendship with them at any time, that you may be strong and eat the good things of the land. And then he goes on in verse 13. What has happened to us is as a result of our evil deeds and our great guilt. And yet, our God, you have punished us less than our sins have deserved and have given us a remnant like this. Shall we again break your commandments and intermarry with the peoples who commit such detestable practices? Would you not be angry enough to us to destroy us, leaving us no remnant or survivor? O Lord God of Israel, you are righteous. We are left with this day as a remnant. Here we are before you in our guilt, though because of it, not one of us can stand in your presence. He is recognizing they are as guilty as they were when they went into exile. And he is pleading with God, do as you know what is right. You are righteous. Your judgment, your punishment, whatever you mete out, God is going to be right. Luckily, and I say luckily, fortunately, there's those there in Jerusalem who want to do right by God, and they want to be obedient. And so they offer this particular plea to Ezra in verse 5 of chapter 10. So Ezra rose up and put leading priests and Levites and all the Israelites under an oath to do what has been suggested. And they all took the oath. Then Ezra withdrew from before the house of God and went to the room of Jehoiachin, son of Elzbib. While he was there, he ate no food and drank no water because he continued to mourn over the unfaithfulness of the exiles. A proclamation was then issued throughout Judah and Jerusalem for all the exiles to assemble in Jerusalem. Anyone who failed to appear within the 3 days would forfeit all of his property in accordance with the decision of the officials and the elders, and would himself be expelled from the assembly of the exiles. So within 3 days, all the people gather, and this is what is said in verse 10. Ezra the priest stood up and said to them, you have been unfaithful. You have married foreign women, adding Israel's guilt. Now make confession to the Lord, the God of your fathers, and do this will. Separate yourselves from the peoples around you and from your foreign wives. The whole assembly responded with a loud voice, you are right. So they're confessing their sins here. They are recognizing that they are not right in the sight of God. We must do as you say. But there are many people here, and it's a rainy season, and we cannot stand outside. Besides, this matter cannot be taken care of in a day or two. So they now are saying, listen, you're right. We are sinful, and we will follow what you have decreed for us to do. We will separate ourselves from our families and give up our foreign wives and our children that we are not lawfully supposed to have under the law of Moses. But give us time. So they take a little bit of time. I think what I read, it was about a month, month and a half, 2 months. And all of the land of those who did wrong in the sight of God were separated from their families. And that's what we see in the latter part of verse chapter 10. It says, among the descendants of the priests and the following are married foreign women. And it lists a long line of people who had married foreign women and had to give this up. So here's the difference, and I want us to see this as the last part of Ezra. Remember how the people of Israel in the past didn't want to give up all of their idolatry and all of their sinfulness, and they wanted to live lives that pleased them and were better for them and more comfortable for them, and that's why they went into exile. God said, if you want to live that kind of life, then that's the punishment that's going to be meted out to you. Here, what a stark difference. These people recognize their sinfulness and they choose to give up that sin. And they choose to follow God. And that's what God was wanting. That is the people God is desiring. Those who are willing to confess their sin and to make a change and to start following Him with whatever consequences are there. What a wonderful, wonderful lesson for us all. Two things I hope we take away from this tonight, and we got just a few more seconds. One is sin has consequences. Some are very, very difficult. Can you imagine these families having been together, living and having children, and to give that up and to let go and to send them away? Now, I don't know to what extent all that was. I'm not going to stand up here and say, you know, they sent them to another land or they, I don't know to what extent that was. I know they separated themselves from their families. But the second one is God is first. And if these people recognize that and they finally got the message, they finally understood after all these years, the Israelite nation, this is the nation God has desired all along. These are the people he's been desiring to have, those who desire to follow him at whatever cost it was going to take. And that is a great lesson for us all. Thank you all so much. I appreciate it. This is my last night of teaching in this quarter, but God willing, down the road, maybe we'll be able to do some more again. Thank you so much.